Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. Click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it is the YouTube channel, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, basically wherever you listen to podcasts, we are available. You can also check us out at patreon.com/sonic cinema. There you will get early access reviews to some reviews that are going to be on the website. You are going to get stuff like Leaving the Collection, Life Soundtrack coming up. We're going to have Oscar Talk and more. That is at patreon.com/sonic cinema. So this is going to be the last episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast for 2024. And it really is kind of fitting that we are ending where we began, and that is with our regular guest on for the fourth time this year, Phil Fasso. And this episode is a bit different. It is a Christmas-themed episode, but maybe not quite what you're expecting from us. I had this idea a couple of years ago. I found it very interesting that this filmmaker had directed two fairly iconic Christmas movies, albeit in very different genres. The director in question is Bob Clark, and the films are his 1974 slasher film Black Christmas and his 1983 beloved holiday classic A Christmas Story. Phil, thank you very much once again for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me as always. And it feels like I'm getting used to saying that. I've been on quite a bit lately.
I know. Like I said, this was your fourth time. This is your fourth time on the podcast this year. And that's been a, we've had you on multiple times in the past, but it's usually like one horror episode, maybe another one for like a different type genre, whether it's like Italian neorealism or Joseph Cotten or something like that. So the fact that we are talking about horror but from a slightly different perspective is a lot of fun, and that's part of why I wanted to do this episode with you, because I thought you'd appreciate this this duo of films to discuss together.
Oh, I certainly do. And I'm so glad you invited me along for this chat.
So I know for me, the one of the go-to holiday classics for me has always been Bob Clark's A Christmas Story. And, you know, when you grow up in the, you know, early 80s, it's naturally going to be one that resonates with you. You know, I will admit though, for some reason up until a couple of years ago, it didn't really register with me that he was a filmmaker who had two horror movies under his belt, and or two Christmas movies under his belt. And I think it's really interesting because there's not too many, I can't think of too many filmmakers who kind of work within the same type of holiday setting multiple times, and certainly not with this wide a variety of the types of stories they're telling. And so that's part of why I wanted to do this. Also, Christmas Story's 40th anniversary was coming up last year, and I love it, so it's like, oh, this would have been great. Ended up not having time for it last year, but seeing as though Black Christmas turns 50 this year, and quite frankly, like literally a couple of days ago, as of this recording, I thought it'd be fun to go ahead and do this year. So you are a horror fan. When was it you first watched Black Christmas?
So I didn't actually watch Black Christmas until after I got a DVD player. I remember that, and I remember getting my first DVD player in 2000. I'm not quite sure because I was definitely late to the game on this one. Like I'd seen all the Nightmare on Elm Streets, the Friday the 13th, the Omens, the Exorcist, all the populist. Well, I shouldn't say all the mainstream stuff that you'd think a horror kid would see in the 80s. But actually, Black Christmas came along a little late, and I rented it on DVD. Actually, yeah, I think I rented it. I rented it from Netflix. Popped it in. It was around Christmas, and I'm like, my God, this is brilliant. And the thing is, so I a lot this I'm tying this a lot to the Larry Cohen discussion we had with the last chat we had,
Yeah, it's alive.
because there are some things going on. Well, let's face it, that movie tiptoed and did some allegorical stuff with abortion and birth. This straight out is it talks about abortion, which for that time is like not really one of those things that got spoken about much in films.
Right.
But also, this is so you mentioned last time that you thought, and a lot of people agree with you, that Texas Chainsaw Massacre is ground zero for the slasher film, right? A lot of people look to Black Christmas and say that's the ground zero, because what happens is 4 years later you get Carpenter with Halloween, which borrows liberally from this in some ways, specifically with the holiday setting and the way that some of the kills are set up. And the thing is that once Carpenter gets in there, that solidifies the tropes. It solidifies a bunch of stuff with filming style and what can be done. And then Friday the 13th takes it further into the gore. But it's an evolution. But some people will say that Black Christmas is the start. And it's kind of funny that I saw Black Christmas long after I'd seen Christmas Story. And we can thank Ted Turner for Christmas Story being popular, because if I understand this correctly, I believe I saw something or read something recently that A Christmas Story really was not a very popular movie when it came out. And Ted Turner decided to show it. I guess it didn't start off for 24 hours, but it became the 24 hours on Christmas Day thing, which made it an American staple at that point.
Well, and and it's interesting because of the fact that, I mean, and I know I listened to 80s All Over the podcast, and they talked about Christmas Story, and it really, and one of the things that I find so interesting about this, I mean, I feel like it's kind of, I feel like to a certain extent, like a lot of the holiday classics that we know and love just didn't really, weren't instant classics. Like, I know nowadays we kind of look to some movies being beloved right off the bat, but I mean, I think with holiday movies, it takes a few years for that appreciation to really get off the ground. I mean, famously with It's a Wonderful Life, the main reason that started to become the beloved classic that it is now is because of the fact that it happened to be in the public domain at the time, and networks would just show it throughout the holidays, and they showed it so much that people just started to make it a holiday tradition. And I think A Christmas Story didn't quite take that long to become beloved. But I do think that I do think re-releasing it in theaters, the advent of VHS coming along at that point, and then of course, to your point, the 24 hours of A Christmas Story that TNT and TBS started to do in the 90s, that's where it starts to take hold that this is a beloved classic. And going back to what you were saying earlier about Black Christmas, I do agree, I will say I do agree with you that this is more of a progenitor to the modern slasher movie than Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But I will say I do think Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that certainly has the basic structure of bunch of teenagers or young adults getting killed by a mass killer on the run. This takes it into suburbia, takes it into a more populated setting where there's a little bit more danger. And I do think in that respect, yes, this is probably closer to the true inspiration for your Halloweens, for your Friday 13ths, for Nightmare on Elm Street after that.
Well, I feel it's great that there's a debate, and I think that there's discussions and points can be made either way. I think that both of them were certainly seminal in building the modern slasher.
Yeah.
Both Texas Chainsaw and the original Black Christmas. You know, so they're both, like, I don't think you'd have what became out of the 80s without both of them there, because they're borrowing parts of both.
Yeah.
And speaking about structure, going back to what I was saying about It's Alive, the structure in Black Christmas, like, because it was the formative grounds and it was the 70s, and the 70s, I believe I've told you before, is my favorite decade for films, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you could experiment in the 70s and you could do all kinds of stuff, and it was just teeming with life and ideas and ways to structure films. Like the way Black Christmas is structured, you'd never have a film structured like that in a modern slasher. It would never happen.
No.
Again, like there's scenes where there are gags in it. There's the fellatio gag with the phone with the cops, which I still find hysterical. And I think Margot Kidder got great credit for being in Superman. I think she's actually just about on par with this role because she is hysterical. She's very funny in this. You know, and there's the whole scene with the dad and the obscene paintings and all this stuff. Like, there's all kinds of – this is the whole subplot with the dad where he sits down with him and he's trying to figure out what's going on. Like, that kind of stuff would just be jettisoned. Somebody would say, hey, it's not important. Get it out of here. You know, they wouldn't take the time to develop those sorts of things in a modern slasher, which is makes this movie really interesting for me, especially because I'd seen it after I'd seen all those, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, so, and you know, the thing you've talked about over the years, or – at least you've intimated to me. We haven't really, I think we discussed in one of your early times being on the podcast, but you are not much of a fan of the slasher genre.
Oh, no.
So I mean, I completely understand. It's like you look at how it feels like every other one is basically just copying the formula, and it's kind of a boring form. It could be kind of a boring formula if you're not putting some sort of twist on it, like Scream did, like Nightmare on Elm Street did, and Halloween did.
And that's the problem with slashers. So talking about Scream real quickly, I don't want to sidetrack you too much. But talking about Scream was innovative when it came out because it's like, okay, we need to do something different here.
Yeah.
And then two things came out of that never should have come out of that. All of a sudden, Scream was saying, hey, these movies are all formulaic. We need to change the formula. Then you had a whole bunch of movies that came out the next 5 years that just copied the Scream formula. Totally missed the point, right?
Yeah.
Totally missed the point of what Craven was doing. And then even worse, Craven goes on and makes more of these things. So it's like that movie should have been one and done. That's the perfect example of... Oh, okay, let's not go into sequels. And I understand that he tried to do some stuff with the tropes of sequels, but by the time you get to the third one, it's like, why am I even watching this? Like, right. Why were they two of these in the last 4 years, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, it's always been two things for me. If you're going to make a slasher and you want to entertain me, you have to have an interesting killer in there. The slasher himself or herself has to be interesting. And then I need creative kills.
Yeah.
And this movie certainly has those in abundance, Black Christmas.
Yeah. Well, and it does have creative kills, and I think this is one of those, because of the fact that it is an early slasher, it's still leaning into the idea of leaving the killer a mystery. So it's kind of playing on murder mystery type tropes. This is really kind of like, this is almost like a dinner theater murder mystery, you know, like one of those weekend murder mysteries where you go to, like a hotel or something like that. And you basically stay the weekend. You try to piece out by information who the killer is. That's kind of what this is. I mean, you do have the instigation to a lot of the terror in this in the obscene phone calls that the sorority is getting. And then you have Jess's boyfriend, Peter, played by Keir Dulay. And then he becomes, well, is he a possible suspect? And then you see basically that the killer's literally, and it's one of the more famous lines in a slasher movie history. It's like the phone calls are coming from inside the house. And so that leaves another bit of suspense of what's happening, who's doing this, and why are they doing this? And it's really just a strong, it's a very strong premise for slasher to build on. And yeah, I mean, Clark did a really terrific job with building that.
Yes, he did. See, one of the things that this movie has that a lot of slashers don't have for me is tension. You can cut the tension with a chainsaw in this movie, Brian. That's how thick it is. Yeah, and the way that scenes are set up, the way that's constructed, the way that it's built up. I mean, the very fact that within the first few minutes you have a girl get killed in the attic. She's got a plastic bag over her head, and he puts her in a rocking chair, and she's there for the rest of the movie. We know that as an audience. The characters have no idea. They're right. Just taking this obscene phone call. They're all getting ready to go home. One of them disappears. What's going on here? But we know that in the back of our minds that the entire movie, there's a dead body in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
Literally looming over everything in the house.
Yeah.
It's brilliantly set up. You know, it's very well put together.
And I know one of the things that I appreciate in this film is, you know, we're so used to filmmaker, you know, with a slasher, you basically have to use visuals to create a certain atmosphere. And one of the things that I love in this film is the way that Clark uses the Christmas setting, not only just to create a look for a horror movie that we'd never really seen before, but also the way he shoots Christmas, and this is true in A Christmas Story as well, is just wonderful. Like, he really is capable of bringing out the joy of us looking at Christmas decorations, Christmas lights, but in this movie, just turning, to your point, turning that screw just a little bit to one side or the other, to where suddenly that lighting has an ominous tension to it.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, I don't normally say this about a film, and, you know, I know people might knock the pacing, especially if they're, you know, younger people, you know, who haven't experienced what it's like to take time and develop things in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel movies, and you get these movies, it seems like everything wants to be 2 hours long today.
Yeah.
And that's not 2 hours long because we're developing that something. That's 2 hours long because they want to hammer you with action scene after action scene a lot of the times, right? Mm-hmm. So the thing here is that this movie takes its time to develop stuff, but it's brilliant the way it does it, because, you know, if you look at the Jason films, all right, you go out in the woods, there's all kinds of nasty stuff out there. There's snakes, there's bears, there's porcupines, there's poison ivy, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there are inherent horrors out there, which, you know, leans into, hey, you know what? Perfect place for a slasher. Okay, this is not that. This is a bunch of sorority girls hanging out, getting ready to go home the next day. They're doing a present exchange, and there's a Christmas tree and lights. It's lit like, and again, brings me right back to my childhood in the 80s, around the Christmas tree, waking up Christmas morning, have mom put on lights, you know? And it comes back to me every time I watch this movie, because you take that very American, very homey, very comfortable holiday setting, and then you turn it on its ear with these phone calls to start.
Yeah. Yep. No, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I mentioned to you in a chat was I thought it was interesting how the beginning of this, during the opening credits of this movie, Bob Clark uses Silent Night over the establishing shot of the sorority house. And then in the last moments when the mother and father are around the Christmas tree late at night on Christmas Day and the Christmas lights are on display, he's also playing Silent Night. And I wonder how much of that was a deliberate... I can't imagine that wasn't a deliberate choice on his part to sort of connect, bookend these two very different Christmas tales with not only one of the most beloved and iconic Christmas carols of all time, but using it in one case to establish the holiday and another one to bring down the release of the tension of what that holiday brought.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that the thing is that Bob Clark was a really smart director, and his early career is so interesting, because I don't think there's ever been a career like it. He starts off making these low-budget horror movies and made Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things, which is very talky and doesn't get really going to last 15 minutes, but Alan Ormsby's in it, and he's incredibly fun. And some of the stuff that goes on there is just so wacky. Then he makes Death Dream, which is more of a, it's a zombie thing, but it's really a one character. It's a character piece about Vietnam and coming home from Vietnam. And that gets into some bloody stuff at the end. But then beyond this, he makes a Sherlock Holmes story with Christopher Plummer and James Mason as Holmes and Watson. He makes the first two Porky's films.
Yeah.
Like, he was just able to, and it's funny because he was in that sweet spot where he was able to be really good at whatever he did for, you mentioned Rhinestone the other night, not my favorite Stallone boy. I'd say anything pre-Rhinestone, he was excellent at doing that, because he was able to go and jump in and out of genres, in and out of the way he filmed, in and out of locations. And, you know, you look at Children Shouldn't Play With Dead Things, you take that and match it up against Porky's, and match Porky's up against the Sherlock Holmes film. You know, none of this, you would look at this and go, how is one guy able to do all this? And it all comes out really well.
Yeah.
So by the time he gets to 74 and he makes this, like, I don't know if he realized how seminal and how important this flick was going to be 50 years later.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is certainly a crown. And to have this crown of achievement and then go on, what, how many years? What year did, was it 82 that A Christmas Story came out?
83. I think it was 83.
So a decade later, he's creating another seminal film.
Yeah.
You know, that lives on 41 years later. And it's kind of funny that HBO Max has it on streaming for free. Mm. You can watch it there. You could set it on loop, I guess, and watch it for 24 hours. But even with that, I know that even though you can get it on all the streaming services, that it's still going to be on TBS for 24 hours this year.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
So if you want to sit through the commercial breaks and you want to put it on the background and just leave it on while you're spending time with your family, opening presents, it's there for you, you know?
Well,
and that's kind of comfort.
Well, that's the thing. That is the thing that is interesting about his about this dichotomy of movies, right? I mean, like, obviously, Black Christmas horror movie, very niche audience. Like, not everybody is going to appreciate it the way that that particular audience appreciates it. A Christmas Story, in a way, sort of predates the holiday movie marketplace that we live in today. And you could almost see it as sort of a jumping off point for that. Not to say it's necessarily the same type of story, but it's tapping into this old-fashioned sense of nostalgia for Christmas when we were kids and what was like to be a kid, what was like to wish beyond wish that you were going to get something in particular for Christmas, what was like to try to build the bridge to get that in your parents' mind, and then what might happen if your dream actually came true.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, I look at it as, when I was a kid, Rankin and Bass was the thing. So every Christmas, CBS would run Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer, CBS would run Frosty immediately after, and then you'd have your Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
I think everyone, the modern attitude with it, with Christmas movies, is everyone wants to make a Christmas classic. And you can't go about trying to make something a classic. I've always said that. You know, you can't, you know, and everyone wants it to be in the rotation. So I think that the last one that probably might, and it's not on the Rudolph level when I was a kid, but I guess Elf is the closest you'd come in the last 20, 25 years. Like, Elf seems to have its following. I don't know.
I would say either Elf as far as live action, but I would say Polar Express is also, it found its niche with younger kids.
Yeah, because Polar Express had a very negative reaction when it came out, didn't it? It's been a while.
But yeah, kind of did, because of the fact that it was that beginning of the, it was the beginning of that
type of CG animation
that was also performance capture, and so you had the characters basically the blank hollow eyes of the main characters, it was hard to really get emotions through those performances. So yeah, I mean, I think Elf and Polar Express are probably like the last two that are like very bona fide holiday classics. But I mean, I know the next year was Family Stone, which I know a lot of people really like. I know I'm a fan of that one. And I mean, you know, in the 90s, one of my favorite holiday movies is also The Ref with Dennis Leary. And I mean, that's because of the fact that I have a very sarcastic sense of humor when it comes to holiday, that particular movie and why it connects to me. But no, I mean, you're absolutely right. I do think a lot of people swing for, oh, we're going to try and make a beloved Christmas classic. And it's up to the audience to decide that. It really is. And, you know, I think that is the thing that people really should have learned from It's a Wonderful Life. Because that movie was not beloved when it came out in 1946. It was not up there with the Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra classics that came before it. And it kind of got forgotten until it started playing on the public domain and on PBS and every year. And all of a sudden, people just responded to it. And you completely understand why people would respond to it. And I also, I completely understand why people respond to A Christmas Story as well, because it's a lot of the same reasons I do as well.
See, I think that thing, the thing that's so enjoyable about A Christmas Story is that it has to be one of the quirkiest movies ever made.
Yeah.
Like, this is not your normal Christmas story. But again, when you look at most of the stuff that's going on here, this is an average American childhood, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so much of it, I never had a bunny suit that I wore for Christmas, but or got my tongue stuck to a frozen pole, yeah. Flagpole. But that's certainly stuff that I could see happening to a child in America, you know? And I can associate with, you know, Ralphie's wanting something for Christmas and am I going to get it or not? Because you put your list together and you hang it on your fridge or you give it to your mom and say, make sure Santa sees this. And then it's a crapshoot after that until Christmas Eve or Christmas Day when you're opening your stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that it's so lived in. And that's part of it, that the characterizations are all perfect. The acting's great. Everyone's on task. They all know what they're there for. Even the kids, I mean, you always hear complaints about kid acting. Nobody ever complains about the kid acting in that film because it's great.
Oh, no. Everybody's – Peter Billingsley is a mate, is wonderful as Ralphie.
Yeah, amazing.
Scott, Zach Ward as Scott Farkas is terrific. I mean, they do such a great job. And to your point, you know, the thing is, it's like this movie is set in – Let's say the 30s. I mean, that is a reasonable one. You look at when Little Orphan Annie was going on, you know, how old Gene Shepard was. He wrote the novel. He provides the amazing narration throughout. And, you know, yeah, so it's set in the 30s, but I recognize... I associate it feels like being a kid did feel in the 80s for me.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's kind of extraordinary about this, where it's like it's while we don't get a time frame, while we don't get a time stamp on the film itself saying, oh, this is set, you know, it's just Gene Shepard saying, this is a Christmas that happened when I was so-and-so years old. Yep. And you don't know when it was, but you recognize so many of the beats. You recognize so many of what it was like to be around other kids, trying to look out for one another, trying to goad each other into doing something stupid. And then, you know, in Ralphie, you know, seeing how he has to react to his mother and his father and his brother, and it's really just wonderful to just you even if you may not have had those specific memories, you still have a memory of what was like at that time for you.
And that's the whole thing, that it's very quirky, but at the same point, it's very universal.
Yeah.
A big part of it isn't just the Christmas thing. It's about Ralphie facing discouragement. Ralphie facing a world that's not always great for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my favorite thing is you got the whole line with he wants the BB gun, the rifleman BB gun.
Yeah.
And everyone keeps telling him he'll shoot your eye out. So my big thing is that my favorite scene in the entire movie, and I don't know if anybody else would say this, but certainly mine, you know, you get the whole thing where they're waiting online to meet Santa Claus, right? Mm. So every wall Santa, I mean, I did it, sit on a guy's lap, mom takes a picture and then hangs it on the wall and you tell Santa what you want, and then the next kid hops on. It's the Santa assembly line that they used to have at every mall in the 80s, yeah. Right? So the best part of that, though, is that he gets all the way up there. He had to climb this immense mountain that Santa's up above. And Santa's trying to rush him off. And what does he say? He wants the BB gun. And Santa, of all people, Santa, who's supposed to be every kid's favorite person in the world, favorite magical deity, entity, whatever you want to call him, he's supposed to be the one guy that'll take care of you. Gives him the same thing. He'll shoot your eye out, and then he shoots him down.
Yeah.
And slide. Oh, it's such a great scene.
Well, and the thing about that, what I love about that is because, yeah, obviously, I mean, you and I both had those experiences of mall Santa, and to a certain extent, I think it still exists. It's just doesn't feel as prevalent as in pop culture as it used to. But the thing that I love about that is that it really is, for Ralphie, it's almost like climbing Everest, right?
Oh,
like he's got to go all the way up. He's trying to make it all the way up before the store closes. And all of that way, he made it all the way, gets to the summit. And to your point, he freezes up at first. And he's like, say something. And it's like, how about football? It's like, no, not football. And then, yeah, when he's, after he says it, he's like, you'll shoot your eye out, kid. And one of the things I like about this film, and I didn't pick up on it until I was an adult, is this movie does very subtle things in terms of laying you on to the myth of the reality about Santa Claus, right? Like Santa Claus in the mall saying, you'll shoot your eye out, basically repeating what his mother said throughout the movie. And then one of my favorite moments that I always liked growing up, but really didn't occur to me the reality of what they were doing, is after Ralphie and Randy go up to bed on Christmas Eve, you have the parents downstairs and they go, okay, get him. Let's get him. Basically implying they're putting out all the presents.
Yes. Yep.
And so, and I mean, for some reason that didn't occur to me that, well, maybe Santa Claus isn't real, or maybe, you know, and you don't necessarily think about that as a kid, but the way that they layer that in is really fascinating and really entertaining.
And it's so, like, so here's the thing that here's the thing that makes this a really interesting discussion we're having here. We're discussing these, normally when we do these things, like, there's a through line, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm able to talk about some stuff that's going on in the last three movies we discussed when we did the 74, right?
Yeah.
Here we're talking about two movies set in the same holiday period by the same director, and I'm not drawing those through lines other than the setting right now, right? I mean, it's fascinating because you could look at these two movies, and if you didn't know about filmmaking, didn't know who Bob Clark was, you could totally believe that these were by two different directors and not even know the difference, right?
Yeah.
And that's fascinating because, to me anyway, you know, Clark is able to, like, he doesn't have a set style or a format. Like, most directors have their you know, their tropes, their styles, their things that are in common. He was able to pretty much, for a period there, just morph into whatever he needed to morph into for the project, which is really interesting. And it's not like he's a schlock director. Like, I really believe that he believed in every project he made. I think there's a lot of love in A Christmas Story. And I believe that, you know, here's a guy who created fear and tension and horror. And you got to be invested in a movie as a director to do that. You know, there's not schlock work going on here. But I'm looking at these films, you know, a couple days ago when you told me we were going to set up for today. And I'm like, I'm trying to find commonalities. And I'm like, I'm not seeing them, you know, because it's so far off. And that's a testament to Clark, to what Clark was able to do, because, you know, a lot of, unless you're like a Spielberg, a lot of directors don't have hit after hit. Like, a lot of directors have that one big movie they made and, you know, it changes. Maybe it changes the genre or something. He did that twice.
Yeah.
Which it's great. It's fascinating, you know, because not many direct at a decade apart and different genres, and he stuck them in the same Christmas setting. It's like, I don't even understand how he was able to do that. Like, because these are two great, great films here that we're looking at.
Well, and I think it is a credit to him that he is able to, that he was able to find what he was interested in doing with both of these stories and make them feel very personal in a way.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, with Black Christmas, I mean, you know, I think there is something very interesting about the way he portrays the relationship between Jess and Peter, who are basically nominally the main characters in that movie. And it's their relationship that causes a lot of the tension in Black Christmas. And then in Christmas Story, you have the way that he creates, if there's one sort of through line between these movies, is that I like that he plays a little bit with genre in his own way in A Christmas Story, because of the fact that this is, because let's face it, Ralphie's journey in A Christmas Story is almost like a child's worst nightmare when it comes to Christmas, right?
Yeah, like, 100%.
You have an absolute passion. You have to get this one thing, and you're trying to maneuver your parents, your teachers, Santa, to try to go ahead and let you have this thing, even though really what they're suggesting could happen is not an unreasonable fear. Like, it really isn't. And I mean, you know, it's fascinating to look at this now and think about modern gun culture. Like, is there, like, it's hard to believe that if a kid said they wanted a BB gun, they wouldn't get it from their parents, more than likely. But no, you can also, but you can also understand exactly why at least the mother, played by Melinda Dillon, is hesitant.
No, in today's culture, it's likely that if a 10-year-old asked for a BB gun, his parents would buy him an AK-47.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, and it's again, part of it, and I totally understand what you're saying, that the mother, see, here's the thing. One of the great things about Christmas stories is it's told from Ralphie's perspective, right? Very clearly. He's got a narrator's voice. That narrator is the guy who wrote the book that it's based on. It's based on incidents from his life, you know? Clearly from Ralphie's point of view. But I agree with what you're saying as well, that, hey, listen, you know, you're giving a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old a BB gun. I had a BB gun when I was a kid upstate, you know? Used to, I don't know what, I mean, you can't really do much with a BB gun. But again, my grandmother and grandfather had a farm upstate. My parents were very clear about gun safety, you know? It wasn't like, hey, here's a BB gun, go nuts in the backyard.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, something like that.
Yeah.
But his parents, we list his parents' expectations and his parents', well, his mother's fears are certainly realistic, you know? And let's face it, the parents are one of the greatest parts of this movie and why it works so well, especially Darren McGavin.
Yeah.
You know, the woman who plays the mother has to play it straight, so she's got the less glorious role. But the two of them together do an amazing job playing the parents in this movie.
Here's what I love about the dynamics with Darren McGavin and Melinda Dillon in this. You know, you're absolutely right. Melinda Dillon is essentially playing the straight man to Darren McGavin's character.
Yes.
But at the same time, she's also playing a bit of a goofball with the kids. Like, especially Randy. And I, you know, the moment where she's trying to get him to eat in the beginning, and she's like, "What? How's the big ego?" And it's just wonderful. It's this wonderful touch as far as how a mother would react to their kids. And this is all very believable. And that's part of why these characters resonate with us so much, is because, I mean, we can see people in our lives as those characters. Like, we can, even if they don't obviously do the exact same thing that the characters do, we can remember moments where our parents behave the same way the parents here do, or, you know, friends daring each other to do something, or having to deal with bullies, and having to deal with teachers trying to kiss up to teachers and stuff like that. And it's just really wonderful.
And see, that's part of the reason why this is a Christmas classic. And I'll go back to what I was saying about people trying to make the next Christmas classic, that it's wacky, it's out there, it's all of that, but it's so relatable on every level with every character, right?
Yeah.
And it's amazing because you see what happens a number of times when things go wrong. Like the fact that they have this big, sumptuous Christmas meal, and then the neighbor's dogs run through the house and eat all the food, and then they're stuck going to a Chinese place because the Chinese place is the only place that's going to be open on Christmas, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's so relatable, you know, just so much of it. And again, you know, it's played for laughs because it's a comedy and, you know, a very, very, very funny comedy.
Yes.
But the thing is, so much of it is relatable, whereas as much as I wanted to see Red One, and everyone tells me it's really bad, even that my friend Chris said it, he took his girlfriend and her daughter out, and they had a good time with it, but they're like, yeah, he was like, yeah, it was fun, but it was bad fun, you know?
Yeah.
But like, I don't see much relatable with a jacked up Santa Claus being protected by The Rock, you know? You right. don't have that human connection there. And that's part of the thing about Black Christmas. You have that human connection through fear. And in Christmas Story, you have that human connection because these are real relatable characters. You know, yeah. These are everyday American characters going through a Christmas. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So all the wacky stuff I can abide by because it all feeds into this being one particularly memorable Christmas for this kid, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, that is absolutely true. And, you know, bringing it back to Black Christmas a little bit, I mean, the thing that I think is one of the things that is so interesting, one of the things that's so interesting about Black Christmas is the fact that it doesn't try to do Christmas iconography in a scary way like other Christmas themed horror movies do. And I like, that's just the setting, but that setting is all you need in order for this to be terrifying.
No, Billy's not stabbing anybody with a candy cane through the eyeball.
Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the thing is that it's so funny because obviously Black Christmas established horror classic. Obviously A Christmas Story established Christmas classic. Everyone who's touched those two things after that has gone so far off, and the attempts have been wild swings, and none of them have become anything that's, for the most part, even watchable. I mean, there are other stories about that family based on the Gene Shepherd writings that never made it big. The sequel, which came out a couple years ago, it's a very Christmas story. Brady, I don't know what it is. I don't remember, but it brings back Peter Billingsley.
Yeah,
I watched it, and a lot of it was, hey, here's the greatest hits and how he deals with them as an adult, right? And, you know, Scott Farkas is in it, shows up. There's all kinds of interesting little pieces in there, but I'm like, did this really need to be made? Yeah, it was fun, but am I going to go back to it ever again? Maybe not, you know? Mm-hmm. And then they had the They've made several sequels to this thing, direct sequels that took place during Christmas, and then there are a bunch of these stories made from Gene Shepard's work that no one even knows about.
Yeah.
No one's even heard of for the most part because they're not in Bob Clark's hands.
Right.
And then if you look at the two attempts at making a Black Christmas sequel, I actually enjoy the 2004 one because it's absolute trash. It's like brilliant trash because it's everything that Bob Clark didn't do is what Glenn Morgan does in that film.
Mm.
Like the aforementioned candy cane through the eyeball, that type stuff. And then, but it's garbage. And then you get to the 2019 one, the one from, I don't want to talk about that. No one wants to talk about that film, Brian. So I'll go that route. And I won't say anything about it because it's just not, it's not even worth a watch.
Yeah.
But that's what happens when you take a director who has a vision and talent, and then you try to spread that to other people who don't understand why Black Christmas or the Christmas story worked in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of fascinating that with several attempts here to reinvigorate both of these one way or the other, either Black Christmas or Christmas Story, none of them have worked. Nobody really can. Huh?
Well, and I think with both of them, they're really, you know, it's really lightning in a bottle. I mean, you just are not going to be able to replicate that same magic. I mean, yes, the characters... Now, I mean, you know, I will say one of the things that's been interesting, you know, talking about another Christmas classic is Christmas Vacation. And the thing that's interesting about that is that it is same characters, albeit different actors every time as the kids, but they're basically doing, it's basically the same type of formula, but in a very different way. And but it's also tapping into the realities and the anxieties of Christmas. And I think that is something that Bob Clark did very well in both of these films. Because I mean, you know, the anxieties of being around the Christmas time also plays a part in Black Christmas as well.
But there's also the very real, and we touched on it earlier, there's the very real world anxiety of a guy gets his girlfriend pregnant in college, right? And this is right around the Roe v. Wade time again. We talked about that with It's Alive. And there's the very, first off, I'm looking at Jess and Peter, I'm like, why were these two ever together? They don't seem like they'd be a good couple at all,
yeah.
Right? He is so into his, like, he's like, hey, I can't talk about you being pregnant right now because I have my piano recital coming up. That's going to be my, you know, my in, right?
Right.
Whereas she's like, hey, I don't care about your life and career. I care about the fact that we're going to have a kid. Like, these two are on opposite ends, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that's planted in here and, like, I remember one of the weird things about Friday the 13th is that one of the girls in Friday the 13th, one of the victims there, is she's pregnant. She's there with a boyfriend. Mm. She mentions this at the beginning, and I don't think they ever mention it again because everyone just becomes slasher fodder because that's what happened. Here it becomes an actual story point.
Yeah.
And is Peter trying to kill her because of the baby? Is he trying to kill her because he can't deal with the relationship? And then you find out it isn't him anyway, and he gets killed.
Yeah.
That poor son of a bitch, Brian. that poor guy. All he wanted to do was play his piano properly, right?
Yeah.
But again, it gives us – not only does it give it a depth that most slashers don't have, it also gives us an in. You know, There are plenty of people who've had bad relationships. There are plenty of people who've had kids out of those relationships. There are plenty of people who've either considered or gone through with abortion. So it gives it another grounding and makes it real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. Whereas, like I said, legitimately, that girl on Friday the 13th, the character says she's pregnant at the beginning and then they never make a point of it again.
Right.
And she ends up getting killed and it's not like this great tragedy because – you know, you should be thinking about the unborn child and all that. Well, none of that happens because it's just – I don't even know why they put that plot point in there if they're not going to do anything with it, you know?
Right. I mean, I can't get too upset about Peter dying because he is kind of a dickhead in the movie.
Oh, he's a definite dick.
He's very much a dickhead in the movie. He reacts exactly the wrong way to Jess when they're talking about that.
And then maybe Hal knew something. Maybe Hal 3000 knew something about it beforehand. But yeah, and then you get to that ending in Brian. Oh my God. If there was ever a shock ending for a horror movie, this would be it. So as you mentioned earlier, and you know, it's kind of funny when you look at movies years and years later, because by the time I finally saw this in 2000, 2001, whatever it was, sometime in the early 2000s, I'd already known about the whole trope about, you know, the calls coming from within the house, right?
Yeah.
And by the time I got to that, cell phones were prevalent. So someone calling you from a cell phone within the house, it wouldn't be a big deal. But back in the 70s, the whole thing is that having two phone lines in a house was like unheard of, pretty much. You had to be like super rich or whatever.
Right.
So this, the phone call from inside the house. So Peter dies and you think, okay, well, maybe this is over. But it's not over because he's not Billy. Billy's still there. And the problem is that, you know, the cops are like, and the doctor are like, well, we're going to sedate her. And everyone's dead in the house. I don't know why they're leaving her there, right?
Right.
The whole house crime scene at this point. Put her up in a hotel somewhere. Have her stay in a friend's dorm room. But then you get the pullback, and it's like, oh, my God. Not only is Billy in the house, but that poor sorority girl still in that rocking chair with that bag over her head. This girl is now sedate, and if Billy decides to do anything, she can't do anything to defend herself. Like, this is a crazy ending, Brian.
Yeah.
Maybe not as crazy as Texas Chainsaw was, because we discussed that ending. But again, this is not a normal movie ending. This is, like, way out there, Brian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's taken swings, and I kind of applaud those swings, because it's like, I've mentioned this to you before. So George Romero's big thing with horror movies, like, everyone's like, you have so many downer endings. And George Romero always said, well, why upset the apple cart with a horror movie if you're going to restore the apple cart and have all the apples in by the end, you know?
Right.
You kind of like want to leave people with that sensation that, oh, no, this is not a good thing that happened here. And every time I watch that movie and get that, it literally gives me the chills. No pun intended, because it's a Christmas movie, but yeah. That is a frightening ending, and, you know, it takes some wild swings, and I got to applaud Clark for going with him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. And, no, I love the swings that this movie takes. I think it is – I think it does some really great, brutal, and – insane things. And I mean, you know, I that's part of why the 70s was such an exciting time for movies, because you didn't feel like you needed to play it safe with the audience. Like,
no, it's not like today where everything's on rails.
Yeah.
You know, everything's got to be on those rails, because we don't want to risk, you know, screwing up this IP or, you know, showing you know, an audience a structure they might not be familiar with. Don't want to actually challenge the audience, you know. But back then in the 70s, you could do all sorts of that stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. This is just a lot of fun discussion. To your point, even if these movies don't have like thematic through lines, I think they are interesting when you take into perspective that they were made by the same filmmaker, and you do see a filmmaker who I think really appreciates the iconography of Christmas and finds his own ways in order to exploit it for these particular stories. Whether they're ultimately hopeful stories or whether they're kind of nihilistic stories.
Certainly. And when we get to the point where we do part two of Bob Clark and it's Porky's 2 versus Rhinestone, we'll see if there's any similarities between those two, Brian.
Well, only if we also include Super Geniuses, Baby Geniuses 2.
Oh, God, it's such a set. So Bob Clark had a very tragic ending to his life. He was driving down the road and a drunk driver was driving the wrong way and smashed into his car and killed him. And I don't wanna lessen that tragedy or make a joke about it, but if you look at the last part of his filming career, it's like, oh boy, he should have stopped.
Oh yeah.
I mean, obviously he's gotta make money, but I'm like, why is he making these baby genius movies? This is a guy who is super ultra talented, and now he's just pushing out garbage that's unwatchable. Even I don't think a 3-year-old would watch those movies and enjoy. Well, but hey, we caught him during this golden period here. We got two great films that we discussed, and I'm glad we were able to discuss these two because, you know, I don't think that a lot of people do this. I think that when you count Christmas, I don't know if it's so much the way anymore, but every, and I think because it's exhausted by now, but for a long time when I got into working for Icons of Fright, and even when I was 4 or 5 years later started Death Ensemble, every year it would be like a retrospective of the Silent Night, Deadly Night films. And I'm like, they're just slasher garbage and they get worse as they go.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very glad that you reached out to me to do this one because this is a real discussion worth having. About a great director who was malleable and able to do all sorts of things. And these two movies, in very different ways, are great testaments to Bob Clark's talent. And
they really are. Yeah. No, absolutely they are. And Phil, as always, is a pleasure. And I look forward to the next conversation we have, whether it's a horror-based conversation, whether it's a different conversation. I look forward to it.
I do too, as always, my friend. Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
I want to thank Phil for joining me once again on the Sonic Cinema podcast. It is always a pleasure to talk to him. And that is going to wrap up the Sonic Cinema podcast for 2024. Technically speaking, this is our 10th year because the first couple of episodes did come out in 2015. 2025 is already shaping up to be a fairly interesting year. I'm going to definitely have some more repeat guests, some guests who you haven't heard before, and we're going to have some interesting discussions in tow, and I'm really looking forward to sharing those with you. Please join us as always. Whether you subscribe, rate, and review at YouTube, Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, wherever you listen to podcasts, or patreon.com/sonicsema, your support is appreciated, or at www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.